Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate everybody taking time this afternoon, or heck, if you're coming in via the archive, for joining us today for a full hour. As a reminder to those that are with us live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the usual suspects. If during the course of the show there is a question you would like for us to direct to our guests, or that you don't think we're quite going in that direction, that's a great place to go ahead and put it in there. We'll be more than happy to steal your good questions and claim them as our own as we go forward through the show. And if you got to hop off halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, if you don't subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, you can always just go over to Blog Talk Radio and get the full archive of this show and all the other shows as well. But now we're going to go ahead and get on with the show. As we put on in the announcements for today's show, we're going to shift a little bit, but not too much. We're going to dive into the world of fiction. Great fiction writing doesn't just entertain, it also informs and causes the reader to think. And I think those latter two qualities are really important when you're looking at military fiction. And we brought on today one of the more popular military fiction books of the last year, the co-author along with P.W. Singer. Our guest is August Cole, and we're going to use as a foundation for our discussion today his latest novel, Ghost Fleet, A Novel of the Next War. August is an author, but he's also an analyst specializing in national security issues. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, where he directs the Art of the Future Project, which explores narrative fiction and visual media for insight into the future of conflict. He is a non-resident fellow at the Modern War Institute at the U.S. Naval Academy at West Point, and he's also a writer resident at Avascent, an independent strategy and managing consulting firm focused on government-oriented industries. He also edited the Atlantic Council's science fiction collection series that my co-host is in the process of reading, War Stories from the Future, published in November 2015. The anthology featured his short story, Ant Farm, about the intersection of swarm warfare, additive manufacturing, and crowdsourced intelligence. So you technology geeks are going to have a great time today. August is also a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Washington and is an editor and a reporter for MarketWatch.com. August, welcome to Midrats.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I really look forward to our discussion today. And I thought as a kickoff to talking about it, because you know, a lot of people think they have a book in them until they actually get down to write it, especially fiction work. And I think and a lot of people are familiar with other authors who have done military fiction in the past, and you know, Ghost Fleet's come on the scene and was rather well received. And I was curious if you could just talk for a minute about the partnership you developed with your co-author, P.W. Singer. And obviously you have the right background to go in the direction the Ghost Fleet goes in, but what was that central beginning that got you to decide, hey, this is the novel we ought to write, and how did y'all partner together in doing that?
Well, that's a great question and the foundational one for any writer. How are you going to get to the end of a 90, 100,000, 110,000 word manuscript? And like you said, we all have things we want to write about, but being able to sit down and do it day after day is a big challenge. And having a co-writer certainly helps. I know this in part because when I decided that I was going to give fiction a shot, I knew that I had to actually leave my daily journalism life that I'd really strived for a long time to get to a place where I felt like I was going to do some really impactful work. And that was at the Wall Street Journal. But, you know, when you're writing so much for a newspaper and on deadline, you know, you have on one hand this wonderfully privileged position to learn about some of the most fascinating subjects in the world, to meet incredible people and work with a great team. But it also, for a mind like mine, I only have so many words in me a day. And I got to a point where I felt like I wanted to give this fiction a shot. And so I actually wrote a manuscript on my own in the early morning, you know, between pretty much like 5 and 7. I was staying home with my second daughter had been born. The kind of drug deal I made with my wife was that I would help and watch my daughter and give a shot at writing a manuscript. And the great thing was, you know, that though that manuscript was never published, it proved that I could write, you know, 90,000 words and pretty quickly. And I'd actually showed it to Pete, who we knew each other from D.C., you know, the D.C. kind of fishbowl. You know, we had occasionally bump into each other on the Orange Line going home. And we started, you know, talking after I moved up to Boston. I'd left D.C. to we started talking about collaborating on a fictional project that would really tackle one of the biggest questions that at the time nobody wanted to discuss, which was China's military rise and what, you know, an open conflict with China might be like, not today, but in the future when China might be, you know, spending as much on defense as we are, or has access to and refined many of the technologies that we feel give us a discriminating advantage, like stealthy aircraft or, you know, battlefield networking, unmanned systems. And so this project really kind of went to that core of what fiction is really good at, which is finding ways to capture a broad swath of attention, to talk about a subject that a lot of people don't really find is on their radar or are very uncomfortable discussing. I don't know if you recall, but, you know, a few years ago, there was a naval intelligence officer who was essentially severely reprimanded, if not fired, for openly talking about the possibility of conflict with China. It's such a different environment today, of course, you know, in 2016, where, you know, the head of PACOM can talk about China as a threat openly in front of Congress and nobody, you know, throws pens at it. So this is the era that the book has come out in. We have the paperback actually coming out next week. The book has been, it's been out almost a year and has allowed people, I think, to have a different kind of conversation, not just about China, but also our own military and its strengths and its shortcomings.
Yeah, when I was reading the book, and I'm a big military science fiction buff, so it struck me that you had tapped into a whole bunch of different historical author threads, from Heinlein to Tom Clancy. And was that kind of the thinking, that the direction you were sort of going with this? Is that a logical starting place to work on a book like that, on Ghost Fleet?
Both Pete and I, when we started talking about the kind of book we wanted to write, kept referencing Red Storm Rising. For both of us, when that came out, we were young but totally captivated by it, and it really, for me, you know, helped me kind of see a world that you hoped didn't come true, but in a really what felt like authentic way, because you saw it from so many different points of view. So, unlike a lot of, for example, the later Tom Clancy books that tend to track a main character, what I liked about Red Storm Rising, and still do, was you got a really good like 360 view of a global conflict. And that was something that inspired us. Now, your point about Heinlein is I'm glad you brought that up, because that I read so much science fiction as a kid, you know, Asimov, Ray Bradbury, particularly a lot of Heinlein, but also William Gibson, was really formative on, and I think probably most impactful of any sci-fi writer, that I can think of in my, you know, kind of broad, reading that I did. And the funny thing about sci-fi for me was I felt like, when I went to college, I studied history and French, and then I started working as a journalist. I actually let it kind of drop off, and I didn't really spend a lot of time reading it. Occasionally, Kim Stanley Robinson would come out with a book, or Gibson. I would read their work pretty religiously when it emerged, but I felt like I needed to read a lot of nonfiction. And in truth, I did. I needed to get smart and be good for my job. And you can't deny the importance of professional reading, but I think, though, all that writing that I had done when I was younger kind of bubbled back up to the surface again when we started tackling Ghost Fleet. And, you know, when you team up with somebody, I think there's a few really important things you have to discuss, whether it's a long, you know, official report or whether it's something like a novel. And I think you really both have to kind of be introspective about what you're good at and what you like doing, and hopefully those intersect and can be complementary. I think you also want to develop a frame of reference, whether in our case it was, you know, books like Red Storm Rising or others like The Winds of War or, you know, some of the early William Gibson, to TV series that are more recent, like Battlestar Galactica, you know, or even Dexter, who's I think, kind of story arc inspired some of our character in Hawaii, who is essentially a serial killer. Well, we really could have really fun conversations about where we were taking the plot, where we were taking a character in reference to the kind of experiences we had. I mean, I think that's what we were going for. We wanted to really, like, dominate someone's attention span because and get them really engrossed in the book. Because when you ask somebody to buy a book, you want their money. You know, you're asking them to spend, if it's a hardcover, you know, up to $30. But you're also asking for their time. And, you know, people can, I think, be more forgiving about spending, you know, money seeing a movie they don't like. But if you waste their time, I think they're really unforgiving. And so that's always at the back of my mind. And the way around that for me was to try to focus on the kind of books that I just never wanted to put down.
And when a lot of people – I'm sorry, do you have a follow-on, Eagle One?
No, you're good.
Okay, I thought I heard your dulcet tones on the other end. We're too polite to each other sometimes. You know, when you talk about science fiction or futurism in that regards, being a Floridian, I always laugh when I go to Tomorrowland out in Orlando. A lot of people are looking beyond the horizon. It gives them time to play a little easy and loose with a lot of things because there's not much of accountability for it. But Ghost Fleet, it's not like that type of science fiction that's over the horizon, far into the future. It's fresh. It's relatively new, though some cards have come out in the deck over the course of years. For somebody who hasn't read Ghost Fleet yet, what time frame from today is the book set in? And why did you pick that type of time?
Sure. I mean, one of the key tenets of the book was that every technology either had to be in development or already deployed. The technology had to be real. We weren't going to, you know, essentially make it a space opera, which is, I think, what you're kind of referring to. There were no warp drives. There was no teleportation. Now, again, that kind of science fiction is great in a certain case, but our goal was to produce something that you could read on the weekend and literally take to work on Monday and think, I need to perhaps do my job a little differently. And so we were aiming for this kind of sweet spot in the mid to late 2020s. We didn't want to be too deliberate about the date and specific at all, because we felt like it would almost be an impediment, you know, to this aspect of science fiction that allows you to accept, you know, certain facts and detail to essentially work your imagination on like a larger, you know, kind of a larger environment, so that you have some things that are familiar and some that are unfamiliar. And I think really effective, you know, science fiction writing and kind of thriller writing for that matter, you know, is quite judicious about what it tells you about the world and what it doesn't. Because when you're not told something, that's when your imagination starts to work. And to me, the great thing about that and the tricky thing is that we all have our own, you know, ideas about what a certain tomorrow might be like and what will influence it. And so you're trying to give someone almost like building blocks and letting them put it together, but still kind of getting the overall shape and form it. But everybody might, for example, you know, visualize a character differently, even if you describe it, or, you know, understand the context of a kind of strategic event differently because of their background knowledge, but at the same time, may be able to use their imagination to, you know, make that leap so that it's more believable. So we're talking near term. And if you look kind of analytically at China's defense spending, and depending on how their economy does and their military spending in response to any kind of hiccups or even you know, stalled growth. But, you know, you're really looking, though, at China's military capabilities increasing faster and faster because of the amount they're spending, because of the experience they're getting, because of the technology they're stealing. So that when you get towards that late 2020s time frame, depending on the forecast you look at, you could see spending that's on par with what the U.S. is spending at. And at the same time, the U.S. is you know, grappling with a lot of structural economic issues too. And so there's a kind of a trade space there in a military sense that is going to be really interesting to watch. And so that's what we wanted to do, was to take technologies that were real, both on our side, but also China's, and, you know, make them available to the reader in this kind of narrative, at the same time, when you thumb to the back of the paper book or you are reading the ebook, yeah, you'll notice it's hyperlinked. There are endnotes, and we were very deliberate in deciding to make this thriller smarter than your average, you know, paperback novel. And the idea was that you could use the book if you were teaching, if you were, you know, using it as a reference in a conversation about, let's say, a technology, you know, like undersea unmanned systems. I had a really interesting conversation when I was down at Fort Benning giving a talk on the book. There was someone from the 82nd Airborne Sergeant, and he's like, oh, you know, I fact-checked your book, and it all checks out. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, we have the endnotes. He's like, no, I did it on my own. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah, I wanted to double-check your endnotes. I mean, so that's how seriously people are reading and scrutinizing the book. And it's scrutiny that I think we welcome, although it sets a pretty high bar. But again, that credibility and believability at the right time, while also allowing the suspension of disbelief on the others, is a really, really important facet of Ghost Fleet or really any good thriller.
Well, when you write a book like this and you sit down and you go, okay, we've got to deal with some major issues that the other side is posing to us, and you do this pretty well in the book, but as you look at it, 2020, 2025, 2030, where are the things that we really need to be concerned about? And I don't want to give away the plot of the book or anything, but you know, for the people who haven't read it, but it has as a defense analyst, as you will, if you will, then what are you looking at? And one of the things I have to keep in mind when I look at China, this is just an aside, is that they don't have to spend as much money on defense because they're not spending any money on much money on developing the stuff. They just steal it. They don't have the same kind of expenditure that we experience in having to create this gear. I'm sorry, go ahead with an answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, I think the other thing to think about, too, is they're not trying to replicate our military ship for ship, airplane for airplane, you know, soldier or sailor or marine for one for one on the personnel side either. They're trying to create a force that can operate essentially to negate or neutralize any of our advantages because they look at what, you know, they might need to use their military for, and it is very much for that purpose. You know, the challenge, I think, in thinking about China is to really understand where the assumptions are that aren't really going to hold up to the reality. And I would actually say the same thing is true about how we look at our own military capabilities. You know, if you war game a program or a concept of operations, you know, you can get to a conclusion that typically justifies, you know, a program of record or a certain kind of spending or makes our allies feel better. But the really brutal and kind of tough intellectually, you know, testing that you can do about some of these concepts, I think actually has a lot more value. And it's often very difficult to do from what I understand bureaucratically because people get mad when they look bad. So what we decided to do in the book was ask some really basic questions. What's going to happen to GPS in wartime? You know, what will war be like in space? Because we are fairly confident, and as we expressed in Ghostly, that the first shots, you know, won't be fired, in kind of an air-breathing environment, but will be in space and in cyberspace. So we spent a lot of time thinking through how might that actually work, and not thinking about it from how the U.S. wants it to work in a validating way, but rather putting ourselves in the kind of planning session of this directorate regime, which runs China in our world, and figuring out how would we go about to do something extremely audacious and impactful that would fundamentally change the way the world saw China's military and strategic reach. And that was a really big challenge because it also asked us to, I think, reassess even something as fundamental as the Communist Party's role in China's near future, which is a very difficult thing to talk about for a lot of people because they only want to think there's two paths. One is the perpetuity of the Communist Party. You know, it has its centennial, which obviously predates the 1949 formation of the People's Republic, but, you know, its centennial is coming up, I think it's in 2021 or 2022. I mean, is it still going to be around? You know, most people would say, yes, it will, and it's going to be around forever, or they'll say it's going to be a democratic revolution, and you'll see a, you know, kind of popular, you know, mirroring of kind of Western democracies. And I don't really think either of those are true. I mean, what I see when I look at the party's inability to manage the economy, it's going to need to sustain and care for an increasingly technologically advanced military that's going to have more ambitions and require more budget and also more political support of a different kind rather than being subservient to the party, which is, you know, technically how it's supposed to work. you know, business is going to get frustrated with that situation too. You know, that The Nation, there's a great UBS report on wealth creation globally. That nation, you know, effectively produces a billionaire a week, and that's a communist nation. So there's a lot of logical inconsistencies, I think, that are really important to unpack. And this is, you know, a long answer to your question, but any of these assumptions that you find people holding really dearly are I think, some of the first ones you have to test. But unfortunately, that's really hard to do. You know, when we look at the capabilities of our you know, weapon systems, and we look at the capabilities even of the way we train and equip and sustain our force, you know, is that actually going to hold up when we need it to the most? And that's, you know, what we were able to do in a fictional context, because it allowed us to, you know, push things further, I think, than you would have been able to do in a more bounded white paper, and to have people relate to that experience differently because you're following characters, you know, not sort of abstract concepts, things, or really data.
I wanted to back up for a second, because I think we can talk about something without giving away too much of the plot, of course. But you mentioned the directorate, and I thought one thing was nice that you and your co-author did is there's been some significant changes in the international pulp mill and economic structures in your future, but none of it is, you know, outside a half a standard deviation of what most people could think is a possibility. Outline for them a little bit what is recognizable in the ghost world future, but what were those significant assumptions people have today about the international pulp mill structure that has changed and affect how things unfold in the story?
Well, you know, one of the really important kind of conditions that we have in the world is that there's been, you know, a kind of severe economic crisis prompted by a catastrophic terrorism event in the Middle East. It's weakened the dollar and weakened America economically. At the same time, though, America has effectively become energy independent. Now, from China's perspective, you know, when we built the directorate, you know, one of the things that kind of helped, I think, get us to that point was asking this question: if I was a billionaire in China, what kind of regime would I want? If I was a PLA general, you know, let's say, or an admiral who's the, you know, at the helm of an organization that is increasingly expeditionary, and has, you know, the largest, you know, navy in Asia, what is my ideal political, you know, relationship with my civilian authority? And I felt like there was a real alignment around those two that would be a very technocratic regime capable of managing the economy with a kind of supermarket efficiency, but having the same political control the party had in a way that fulfilled the military's ambition to, you know, be, in a kind of Meihan sense, a guarantor of China's economic order abroad. And I think that's rooted in today's PLA Navy, where the way they kind of revere, you know, Alfred Thayer Meihan, and a lot of the writing on how to project power and underpin it, how to project economic power and preserve trade with the Navy. So stepping back, you know, there's some other really interesting dynamics too that don't have much to do in the pulp mill context, but affect them nonetheless. And the thing that we had fun with was something like what we knew as Google Glass, but much more kind of comprehensive, in that imagine wearing, you know, spectacles or glasses that allowed you to see, you know, virtually different environments, but also record and observe, so that you effectively don't have to remember anything anymore. And we felt like that actually would be a really interesting generational challenge to try to unpack during wartime, when you need people who know how to bend metal and weld, for example, with people who know how to essentially leverage all this next generation technology. Because that has profound, you know, impacts too in that kind of context. And a lot of times when you look at the sort of books that are written about these kinds of questions, you know, China's military rise, it's not going to really step back and unpack, like, what's it like to work in a shipyard in wartime when there are these vast technological gulfs between generations. And so, you know, that's been something that the book allowed us to do. The other really interesting, we had a review that the CIA put out publicly about Ghost Fleet, saying they liked the book, but what they liked about it was the way it portrayed intelligence collection in the future. So we had both human signals and a couple other kind of next generation types of collection and exploitation in the book that they kind of cued on. And again, a lot of that was about taking some of the assumptions about the way we did things in the 20th century and are starting to do differently now, kind of walking forward in a somewhat more extreme way.
as you, after you finish the book, and has there been, do you perceive an acceleration of technology, which is even faster than what you projected in the book, or do you find that it's going about the pace you thought it would?
That's a really good question. I think the challenge is the technology is probably accelerating in many cases faster. Like I think around virtual reality and augmented reality, and so the augmented reality is what we're talking about. I think that actually is looking more promising than I probably would have expected, despite Google Glass dying off in the middle of us writing the book, which made me and Pete kind of both go, uh-oh, did we weave this, you know, game-changing technology and that's you know, way too ahead of its time or something. But you can just see that actually is going to be real. You know, I think the other challenge, though, the flip side of that is, you're seeing the attempts to onboard next generation technology from the civilian sector into the military realm, like the Defense Innovation Unit experimental DIUX out in Silicon Valley, you know, the other third offset technology driven initiatives. And you see how hard it is to transform organizations internally to be ready for that kind of technology. So I think the pacing factor, even if the technology starts to really move ahead in certain directed or electronic energy weapons like railguns or lasers, or whether we see the loyal wingman concept we play with the book as in having a man fighter with a high-performance aircraft as a wingman. I think the internal kind of challenge that the Defense Department faces is bigger, really, than the engineering one. You know, the human piece is always the tough part. And that's why I really focused on that in the book. Like, how do you fix that when you don't have a choice? And what we found was, you know, it's not going to be the, you know, same kind of heroes and to some extent villains that you might expect, that the people who do rise to the, you know, nation's call may not be the ones even in uniform. And I think that to me is a really important thing to consider about where our strengths come from as a nation and how we can, you know, think about leveraging like all facets of our society if we got into something that felt like a total war conflict, which I think would be really, really disorienting for our political system, if not our, you know, obviously our economy.
Speaking of developments of the last year since you published the book, Russia does play a role in the book. And I was curious, the Russia and Ghost Fleet world, if the last year has been a very interesting one on a newly aggressive Russia, and we're seeing a few more of their desires and capabilities. What were your thoughts about the developments and advances in Russia's aggressiveness in the last year inside the context of your Ghost Fleet Russia?
It's a really interesting thing to watch because we made Russia a junior partner to China. And I think that still feels like a call that reflects their direction. But what's interesting to me is watching some of the moves in Europe, which are, you know, subversive and quite finely tuned and orchestrated to, you know, leverage Russian power without a lot of, you know, overt military action, doing things that are part of a narrative to develop. Yet in the Pacific, they're still working quite economically synchronized with China, you know, whether it's oil and gas relationships. You know, there clearly is a sort of choice being made strategically to focus on Western and Northern Europe or the Arctic and not Asia. And I think that's an interesting strategic choice that isn't talked about often, that Putin's Russia has made. And what that means for China will remains to be seen, because is Russia going to be a useful partner, a willing partner, or will there be areas of non-alignment? You know, China's own military is more self-sufficient and requires, you know, less Russian imports than it did, you know, 20 years ago, obviously. So some of these kind of economic at a military relationship level, economic linkages are changing. You know, are they going to do more joint exercises together? Certainly, and you're seeing, you know, some of that already. What's interesting to me, though, in Europe is that if you think about, you know, China's ability to exert economic power in kind of Northern Europe, even Southern Europe to some extent, you know, they're going to have to be always mindful of what Russia is doing as well. And they don't have a choice at this point but to kind of be synchronized. And I don't have a good read who's leading, but to me it feels like You know, Russia is sort of following, is rather leading, and China is kind of stepping back and just watching all that kind of unfold. When you think about the very, you know, very clear choices that Putin is making, which is to test the validity of NATO, that totally aligns with China's worldview, it seems to me, on how it's testing very basic concepts like the law of the sea, how it's testing the treaty alliances that the U.S. has, you know, sworn to uphold in the Pacific. So I think anything that invalidates a U.S.-led international order and system is like a positive sum game for China.
I want to shift direction a minute and talk about the other work that we had in the advertising for this show. Work you did, edited for the Atlantic Council called War Stories from the Future, which includes your short story, Ant Farm. Can you tell me what the Atlantic Council is doing supporting a book based on speculative fiction and also art? And talk a little bit about the difference between what you were doing with Ant Farm and what you guys did with Ghost Fleet.
So the Atlantic Council for about 2 years now has been working on this really hard problem in a really unusual way. And the problem is, you know, the national security community has this array of threats and challenges that the kind of conventional approach to trying to figure out and forecast aren't really up to the job. That you have so many smart people trying to do, you know, impactful stuff, and it's either not getting read or it's being written in a way that isn't accessible to the people who really need to be understanding what those challenges are. You know, a good example would be, you know, thinking about something like, you know, swarm warfare or, you know, bio-enhanced weaponry and targeting. So with the Art of Future Warfare Project, which is now called the Art of the Future Project as we move beyond just focusing on conflict, we decided to see if we could make this case that writers and video game designers and directors had, and visual artists, you know, had something to offer the defense community in two ways. The first was just visions of the future. The second was how they work, you know, how they collaborate, how they come up with their ideas, where they get them, how they share them. And I think the answer is, after doing that for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, is absolutely it's relevant. And we've seen that in kind of practical ways, from the way the military has shared the War Stories from the Future collection to work that the project has done with the Marine Corps in their warfighting lab on their Futures Directorate's report on the world of 2030 to 2045. So the anthology, when we were mapping out our goals for the first year, was like the grail. You know, it was the one document, the kind of legacy that we were going to try to leave, even if the project failed. Because we didn't know. It was an experiment. I mean, much in the same way Ghost Fleet was an experiment, too. And we had set out, actually, to have a kind of reach objective of having General Martin Dempsey essentially pay attention to the book and maybe, you know, talk about it or, you know, put it on a kind of recommended list or something like that. And the way we approached this was we ran a series of short story contests, and the winners were included in the collection. We had everybody from, you know, a former Hellenic Navy officer to a 19-year-old kid from Chapman University to a woman who's now a state lawmaker in the South to, you know, really, really kind of innovative and smart sci-fi writers, many actually kind of getting attention for the first time in this way. And then we also commissioned writers too. We reached out to people like Ken Liu, who's an award-winning science fiction writer, some of our fellows at the council like Jamie Metzl, who's a bio expert, Matt Burrows, who used to run the National Intelligence Council, is actually a great science fiction writer as well. I kicked in that Ant Farm story. And so we produced this collection. It has some visual art, too. And we actually asked General Dempsey if he would write the foreword, and he said yes, and wrote a really wonderful kind of explanation of why science fiction matters. And it comes down to this, is that it allows you to, you know, think about the unthinkable. It allows you to, you know, kind of read diversity and kind of perspectives and opinions in a way that is engaging and that has value. What's great about, I think, his approval, if you want to call it that, of the effort, if not the stories, is, you know, this is someone who's got an MA in English literature from Duke, yet, you know, was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And so the collection is free. You can download it at the Art of the Future Project website. You get some great fiction in there that to those technologies I was discussing earlier, like bio-enhanced targeting. So Jamie Metzl has been writing fiction about this question, kind of the near-term science fiction. And he wrote a wonderful story called A Visit to Weizenbaum, which is about essentially not the technology itself, but what is it like to be a human, you know, operating remote weapons in an environment where you have to be so isolated from the battlefield, from the rest of essentially society, because otherwise you'll die. And it's about his kind of discussion and conversation with a therapist. It's fascinating, and it totally approaches it differently than if we had written a traditional think tank report about these technologies, or Ant Farm, which is essentially taking things like the Bellingcat crowdsourcing of intelligence and our obsession with social media and celebrity to some extent, and overlaying it with our, you know, growing call and real desire to reduce civilian casualties and have kind of greater control over what happens in the battlefield. At the same time, technology is so hyper-lethal, and it kind of wrestles with some of those contradictions. It's a pretty grim story. I mean, this is one of the challenges of science fiction, I think, is that how do you write it in a way that isn't all doom and gloom and make you just feel like you want to crawl in a cave and, you know, let the future pass you by. But at the same time, I think, you know, science fiction can be incredibly cautionary, too, and there are times when it's appropriate to kind of sound that alarm, which is, I think, what Ant Farm does. So that collection has been a success. We've had, like, I think, 13,000 downloads of it, which for a kind of a first-time publisher like the Atlantic Council is fantastic. And so now we're in our kind of next phase of the project, opening it up. We're working with Matt Burroughs, who's at the Council, on something called the Global Trends 2035 Report. We'll be doing some similar stories. And leveraging some of the work that's been done, but also running more contests to get more writers. So when we get those contests up and online, we'll be certain to pass it away.
And kind of pulling the thread on an author discovering things in the course of writing a book is some of the programs that people in the military chatterati like to talk about, whether it's the F-35, LCS, DDG-1000, they all have various roles and appearances to play during the course of the novel, among other ones. In the course of writing the novel and researching it, what were some of the things that you either discovered or changed your mind about those systems at the end of writing the novel than you had preconceived of those systems going in?
I think the way we tried to think about it was always from the adversary's point of view. So in a sense, it was like discovering something anew. You know, I've been writing about or following the Joint Strike Fighter literally for 16 years, you know, from back when I worked at MarkWatch, the Wall Street Journal, when, you know, I was part of a team that broke stories on it being hacked. We tried to kind of think about it in a opportunistic way, any of those platforms that were involved. How would you disrupt them? How would you, you know, interfere with them working as the U.S. wants them to? With the you know, kind of ship that's on the cover of the book, the DDG 1000, I think we felt like it was a really interesting challenge to write about life aboard a ship that had never really, you know, been to sea in an operational capability yet, and that neither of us had been aboard either, which is a huge, like, creative challenge in and of itself. You have to seriously make a leap and just kind of tell yourself that you can try to pull that off. You know, the assumptions I think that I had going in was that we were better protected on the cyber side than it turns out we are, and that our ability to affect operations in space too is more limited than I, as a, you know, person, I don't hold a security clearance, so, you know, there's certainly layers and layers of the onion that I'm not privy to, but from what is out there in a kind of you know, layperson's, you know, taxpayer sense, was how vulnerable we are. And how much of what we want to come true on you know, the day when it needs to most, it may not at all.
Hello?
I think we have lost our guest. So, hey.
All right. Well, get him back quick.
We'll get him back. Yeah, I think we're going to have to do that. So, I guess we'll continue tap dancing while I recall our guest.
I was going to say, you can also get his work.
Hey guys, it's fitting that in talking about technology, not working, that I hit the hang up button on my phone. Sorry.
Never underestimate the human element.
We only have one button to push, and we both manage to hit the wrong one all the time. So we understand.
It's actually a worthy point. The human element in all this technology is so important too, and I think that's another facet of vulnerability that I didn't appreciate. That the very annoying, routine updates of Adobe Flash that every computer user, deals with, like it feels like on a weekly basis, are like life, literally almost potentially life or death, matters when it comes to combat systems. That, that did you put the latest patch in or not? And that, flipped on its head, led us also to explore with our insurgency in Hawaii, what would it be like to fight against an adversary so technologically advanced like our Chinese occupiers that your only hope of countering them was to go extremely low tech. And this to me was one of the most fun facets of the story, was trying to fight, to imagine fighting in a wholly analog, to be an insurgent and really, exploit technological reliance in a way that allows you to do something impossible, which is simply survive in an environment of literally total surveillance. There's another character that we use to do that, who's effectively a serial killer. And she's important for a couple of reasons. That one is it's a very, kind of intense part of the story. Some of the grisliest facets of the book occur in scenes with her. But on the other hand, it asks, I think, a really important question of the reader to consider, which is, how does war change people and change some people for good? And we didn't want to kind of shy away from those kinds of questions either, in terms of how the way the tactics our insurgents employ, essentially really, really, mess with them emotionally and psychologically because they're willing to literally do anything to win. And so, for me, that analog form of warfare and its costs on both the people who are, executing those kinds of operations, but also on the adversary they're targeting, is a really important thing to think about, because, when we talk about, let's say, the third offset strategy, one of the key tenets of it is that you'll have a very transitory technological superiority. And so you'll have moments when there is, complete connectivity and then degraded, and it will cycle in kind of unpredictable ways. So being able to operate with, and kind of conceive of a day in the life, if you will, in that manner seems really, really important to me. That the playbook that you get issued, so to speak, has to be able to give you the kind of tools to operate and think on your feet, much faster and faster than we've been expected to so far. Which, again, you start thinking about artificial intelligence and machine learning, and that learning cycle on the human side gets even more difficult. So that's to me one of the really kind of interesting aspects of that technology is when you take it all away too.
Yeah, next thing you're going to ask of our people is that they learn how to navigate using the stars again and sight reduction books and all that stuff like I used to do when I was a navigator on ship, instead of just relying on GPS to know where the heck they are. You were talking earlier about how most science fiction ends up being kind of glum, and I thought it was really interesting you started off Ghost Fleet with a Russian talking about, actually fairly positively, about the bright future portrayed in Star Trek. Can you kind of discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, that was important, I think, as a nod to other people who are, I guess, Trekkies out there. I mean, we use Klingon because it's great, as far as a kind of code out there. But also, it is a nod to, the fact that there are visions of the future where it doesn't end up like, Cormac McCarthy's The Road or, some of the really dark apocalyptic tales out there. And even Ghost Fleet itself, I think, because we show how America can triumph over adversity, but just in different ways than we kind of expect in a typical Washington way. that are most important, you know, most decisive people in a future battle may be, you know, Silicon Valley billionaire. Or it might be an insurgent in Hawaii who, you know, used to operate fly Ospreys. You know, the really kind of fun part about, you know, thinking through that Star Trek facet right there had as much to do with the characters we were trying to create, because we wanted people to relate to them. You know, for all the technology we have in the book, and I think this is one of the biggest challenges we had in writing it, because it's, you know, it's 400 pages about. And that's not a lot of time to get to know, you know, so many characters. And I think one of the criticisms I kind of agree with is that, you know, we didn't develop a lot of the characters too much. And I think we actually did a great job given the amount of space we had. Because when you actually step back and see how many scenes you get with each person, it's just simply, you know, literally physically not possible. So those kinds of small details like that, like somebody, you know, using a common affinity or Star Trek to try to, you know, help signal a willingness to help the American side, I think, you know, offers a little bit of richness in what otherwise, if you do it badly, could be a cardboard cutout character. You know, to your earlier question in the conversation about like kind of how we did it, you know, we actually went and deconstructed the story, so we almost made effectively like color-coded storylines, so you could see that each character in the kind of main basket of our main characters, they had to be able to have a kind of enjoyable storyline to read without any of the others out there. They would kind of stand on their own, because we felt like that would at least allow us to, you know, build something which would be, you know, because we all drift in and out and we read a little bit, and people relate to certain characters more than others, that we would really be able to give someone an experience that felt like connected with them and stayed connected with them throughout the whole book, which when you have a lot of characters is tough. I think the audiobook, actually, for any of your listeners who are so inclined, it does this really well. I've had a few people who aren't necessarily deep readers of like sci-fi or military thrillers really enjoy the audiobook, because it helped them kind of keep pace and get things more clearly set up in their head about what was going on and kind of who was involved than when they read it.
Since the you just mentioned one of the aspects of the book I found interesting, in just wondering how you put it together, is besides for a few sectors on the Missouri-Kansas border, Americans haven't actually engaged much as insurgents. We had a couple people in the Philippines that did that for a few years. But we're more on the receiving end of insurgencies vice the giving end of insurgencies within living memory. But there is an insurgency that does take place on American soil in the book. And I was curious, what modern templates did you use when trying to get your mind around how Americans would conduct an insurgency?
You know, one of the things that comes through in some of the tactics that are employed, it goes back to the 80s and actually the Afghan Mujahideen. You know, for example, in our insurgents, they have to figure out how to hide from quadcopters and you know, other aircraft that are searching for them with infrared and other, you know, sensors. And so they employ some tactics, I don't want to spoil them, from the 80s that are extremely simple and crude, that aren't perfect, but it's essentially a better workaround than almost anything else they could do. You know, the use of IEDs is something we have our characters doing, and that, of course, is drawn from, you know, contemporary conflict, too. The really kind of core question of, I think, how would we operate as insurgents after, you know, being counterinsurgents for you know, the past essentially 15 years, and I felt like the answer was, you know, we would be really effective at it, and there would be a very interesting paradigm for somebody reading the book, you know, particularly in the Army, I think, to kind of see that story told from a different perspective. You know, one of the really interesting characters that I had fun with is a Russian, essentially a counterinsurgency advisor who's from their Russian Alpha group. Is a veteran of future conflicts that we have in the book, and his role is really marginalized as he's trying to advise the Chinese officer he supports. because the officer believes that his way is really the only way to solve the problem of this American insurgency. And the Russian has a much more nuanced and kind of studied and to some extent fatalistic view of the task of you know, waging a counterinsurgency. That's a good part of the book, I think, for you know, the land warfare community that otherwise, I think, when it first came out, you know, there were a few people in the Army who were, I think, trying to figure out, well, where is the Army? And one of our best reviews is by Joe Byerly, who said, the Army's not there, and that's the point. That's why we need to read this book within our community. And since then, there's been a huge amount of interest, and thankfully, in kind of the irregular warfare aspects for this very reason that I've been talking about, that, you know, all the issues are there, they're just told from different perspectives. And I think that's even in of itself kind of an interesting thing, that we're used to looking for answers that look a certain way, and it takes a minute to kind of recalibrate and find them.
So after you work on a book like this, do you build a Faraday cage around all your stuff and dig a deep hole someplace and put 6 months worth of food in the underground somewhere, or have you changed your life at all in looking at the threats that you see down the road?
You know, even when I was a reporter, I remember getting advice from someone in the security community who essentially said, on Chinese New Year, just send yourself a message that says, you know, Happy New Year. you know, so I think even at that point in my career, when I was reading the Wall Street Journal, I was always very aware of, you know, the chance or the likelihood that, you know, people could be reading my emails, you know, from whatever government. You know, as an individual now, I think I am more serious about cybersecurity, but I also am more aware of how easy it is to kind of crack the really hard, you know, defenses that even more sophisticated, you know, outfits than, you know, me in Boston and have. I think redundancy is a bigger takeaway, and the ability to think through, if I lost my laptop, could I do my job? Could I keep writing? Could I, you know, work in with my other entities that I'm involved in? And so figuring out kind of smart ways to make sure that I'm resilient, that's a word that I think is one that comes to mind a lot when I've read, when I have conversations about the takeaways from the book, is that we just need to be more resilient individually and collectively. And then to not have the impulse to move, you know, back to Washington State and find some place out in the Olympic Mountains, you know, and start planting my own vegetables and raising chickens, but rather, you know, living in a metropolitan area like I do, to realize that really it's our connectedness, you know, that hopefully can be part of what keeps us, you know, safe when we really are tested, and that the relationships you have, you know, matter more than any one, you know, kind of one thing you've stockpiled or anything like that, because you just can't, as an individual, you know, overcome the kind of enormity of some of these problems. And I think hopefully that's one of the messages in an intergovernmental sense that Ghostly, you know, is giving to, you know, people in the DOD or the intelligence community, is that, you know, the collaborative facets of, you know, hunting terrorists, we know really well. We've seen that done, you know, time and time again very effectively. But there are, at the kind of macro strategic level, the ability to collaborate and to do cross-teaming and be very inventive in a bureaucratic way, I think is just so important. And the more, you know, often that can happen, the better off we'll be, you know, in the next 15 to 20 years as China rises.
I didn't think I would wind up referencing this movie in the course of the show, but as somebody who has children of a certain age who's grown up, I've watched Shrek maybe 14 too many times. But one of the scenes that still makes me laugh is the Lord Farquaad scene as he's torturing the little gingerbread man. I think his attitude towards the fairy tale creatures is not unlike a lot of people's positions in power, attitude towards journalists and authors and people that, if they're not speaking uncomfortable truths or at least asking uncomfortable questions. And there are a lot of people who aren't just making a lot of money, but also have a lot of their personal reputation and just plain ego written into the concepts of we're going to have this great military with this celestial network, all based upon the assumption that we own the electromagnetic spectrum like we seem to have for a while. And you can get interesting reactions when you push back against that template of future that they see. And this book really touches a couple of those tender spots. And I was just curious, what type of reaction have you gotten from that particular mindset that sees the future of all networked, everything working in our favor as we march towards that shining city on the hill? And has any of it been curious or positive? I'm just curious what type of reaction you've gotten.
The reaction has been positive for such a negative, you know, book in that facet, you know, that it's really interesting to see. And it's actually better than I had expected. I had anticipated getting a lot more pushback from, you know, folks whose equities had been really challenged by this book, you know, and you know, in private, maybe, you know, there's grousing, but from what I've, you know, had from people face to face or even in kind of a secondary sense, has essentially reinforced that people want to talk about the problems, but they just don't know how. You know, some of the speaking I've done on the book has literally been, you raise all the fears we have about our future, you know, capabilities around networking. Please come tell us, you know, be the bad news guy to explain to us why this may not happen. You know, I had a conversation recently that I didn't expect was going to go well because of the way the book had challenged some assumptions about some technologies, and it turned out that person actually loved the book and was giving it to people in part because the book had challenged some of these assumptions. So I take heart in that, not in so much that, you know, it's the book itself, but rather the book is a way to talk about really difficult things in a fairly like bureaucratically safe way. And so my hope is that you can, you know, discuss things like cyber hacking or, you know, vulnerabilities in space or our limitations, you know, with training or other technologies and start to do something about them, or at least, you know, be able to nudge the needle towards a solution a little more easily than before, because you suddenly have a common thing you can talk about or point to and say, yeah, we don't want that to happen, because we depict it pretty, you know, the book is a very visual book. I mean, we like, both Pete and I, you know, really kind of rich writing in that sense that you want to kind of feel you're in the middle of the scene. And I think that helps, to be honest, because it allows people to experience it without actually having to live it. And there's literally nothing in the book we want to come true. So the idea is to do as much as possible out there to help avoid that kind of scenario. So, you know, we're going to keep, you know, taking the opportunities we have to, you know, engage with people and talk to them about the issues the book raises, and hopefully they'll be as kind of open and willing to do so as they have been so far.
Yeah, I thought when I read your short story Ant Farm that you you cover a couple of really interesting things. First was an aircraft that contains enough additive manufacturing equipment to produce its own weaponry as it's going along, which I thought was a very interesting concept. And then the other side of it was that the pros and cons of crowdsourcing, especially for the pilot of that aircraft, as it turns out at the end. And I thought that was one of the great things about science fiction or speculative fiction is that it allows you to play with those concepts. Is that a similar thing you were doing with Ghost Fleet, and that you had some pros, some cons, and how obviously it's worked out for you pretty well, but how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Ant Farm story, I think, did something similar. It was a little more speculative, for example, because, you know, in that story, we're talking about, you know, a platform that doesn't quite exist yet, you know, essentially a 767 gunship that has, you know, these additive manufacturing fabrication machines on board and can, you know, respond with swarm type, you know, capabilities, and kind of a close air support role. You know, that was a really interesting one because, again, I tried to think about it practically, you know, even the aircraft type, I had a different aircraft in mind when I started writing that story, but I talked to a pilot of, you know, big four engine military aircraft. And he said, you know, you don't have enough endurance in the range and the aircraft you originally wanted to do. He's like, you should think about something else. So that strived to be realistic, but also, you know, kind of a out there one as well, because it posits, you know, that your average American might be, you know, watching, you know, kind of real time theater engagement operations from the comfort of their home on their smartphone, more or less. And and weighing in on essentially who lives and who dies, because they spend the hours they would otherwise be watching celebrities or something else getting involved with the lives of the people who live in that area, watching them, from afar. With Ghostly, since we're tethering all the technology in real world engineering and pushing it a little bit in certain areas, like, spies who are chipped and have collection, capabilities under their skin, although for all I know, we might have that now. The idea was we would be able to talk about some of the things that we felt if we were worried about as the writers of the story, or saw the potential in other capabilities, like the manned-unmanned teaming, we would be able to shed light on it and do it in a way that really looked at the human element. In our manned-unmanned aircraft combat scenario, a lot of the description is actually about how that human pilot feels about having a robot wingman. Just like an ant farm, the sole human operating this giant 767 gunship, which is effectively flown by Liza itself, spends a lot of time dreaming. He's kind of in this like half awake state most of the time, waiting for fire mission. Really kind of exploring what's that like at the human level, because I think any story, and particularly when you're trying to write something that is relevant, if people are going to connect with it, they have to connect with the characters and the kind of journeys and struggles that they're on, both good and bad, because no hero is it's only as good as his villain or her villain.
Well, August, this has been a great hour discussion, and we're already in the post show where people can listen in on the archive. And obviously, this isn't the last thing, Ghost Fleet, that you're going to be writing. So, curious, what do you have in work right now? And if people want to read more from you or your co-author, what would be a good place for them to go keep an eye open for it?
Well, we're Pete and Albie are collaborating again. We're still keeping our idea in the skunk works that we operate. But yes, we are committed to working more on fiction and as a way to think about the future of conflict and security. My website, augustcole.com, is a good way to keep track of kind of what I've been up to for the Atlantic Council. You can go to artofthefuture.atlanticcouncil.org, and you can see everything there from the free download of our short story anthology to our latest commentary from people like World War Z writer Max Brooks, who's a fellow to the short stories that won contests. And then for Pete, you can go to pwsinger.com, or of course the Ghostfleet Book website, which is ghostfleetbook.com. And our paperback comes out next week, so for folks who've been holding off for that or are looking for something to travel with this summer, thankfully that'll be available very soon.
Excellent. Well, really look forward to seeing it, August. And again, thank you very much for taking an hour out of your Sunday to spend some time with us.
This was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks a lot for being here with us today, August. It's been great having you on.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening to another edition of Midrats. Please join us again next Sunday, where we will have returning guest Bob Farley. He'll be on to discuss, and maybe with a couple of other people, the Battle of Jutland, and also his latest book that just came out this March, The Battleship Book. Until then, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, dear.